No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation. You can call in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. And we have a special guest with us tonight. We'll bring him on in a minute. His name is Bill Moseley. Bill's a great guy, and he's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, and he's been a longtime member of that organization, and he's going to explain it to us, and we're going to talk about it and hopefully get to the bottom of what this all means. But first, let me introduce my vivacious and ever-enchanting co-host, Maria Sanchez. How are you, Maria?
Aren't you sweet? I'm great, Michael. And, as the years go by, and I've cut my teeth with you on Shadow Politics, I think we're going on 4.5 years now. I just want to let our listeners know how I am enamored and astonished and grateful for what you and Mrs. Brown have done for democracy and for the District of Columbia and the statehood rights, that you toil tirelessly and without reimbursement, I might add. People probably don't know that you do what you do. And I can't imagine more dedicated people than you and Mrs. Brown.
Wait a second. Why are you giving Mrs. Brown credit? Just because she picks on me?
Because she, if it weren't for her, this wouldn't be possible.
Well, that's true. If it weren't for her, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning, I don't think. So I guess she does deserve credit.
We should let our listeners know, too, that not only is Mrs. Brown intelligent and attractive and adorable and learned with her master's degree, but she's the mother of your three children, which is the best asset that you've produced.
Yes, she is the mother of my three children. And unfortunately, I made the big mistake of letting her get all the children on her team. So now they've organized against us. So I guess they are really like the socialists inside my family. They've organized their labor activists, and basically they work to make a better life in spite of me. So
no, because
with that beginning, let's introduce our guest. Bill Moseley. Bill's a great guy. He's been involved in the statehood movement. I've known him over the years, and we welcome him to the show. He's like I say, he's been a member of the DSA for a long time, and we want him to explain to us what this means and what the goals are of his organization, and as we see Bernie Sanders, for example, describing him as himself as a democratic socialist, what that means to America and what we can expect from the DSA. So welcome, Bill. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. And I always say I've enjoyed working with Senator Brown over the years on D.C. statehood and self-government, and you've done a great job for the citizens of D.C., so I'm glad to be with you.
Thanks.
Michael, may I ask, is the DSA a part of the Democrat Party, or is it a standalone silo?
Yeah, it's completely separate. And DSA often works for progressive Democrats, and also there are Democrats who are members of DSA.
So you can straddle both worlds?
Right. And okay. so many Democrats who are members of DSA and a few office holders, but we are a separate organization and not under the Democratic Party umbrella at all.
Do you register as a Democratic Socialist?
Me personally or DSA members generally?
DSA generally.
It varies. DSA members around the country, and how the party registration works varies from place to place, but I'd say probably a majority of them, when they register as a party, probably are Democrats. But for instance, in D.C., a substantial number of statehood Green Party members have been involved with DSA. Hilda Mason, for instance, statehood party member of the D.C. Council, was a DSA member for a long, long time.
So she was
independents, probably very few Republicans, but.
Yeah. Well, and just, since you brought up her name, let me tell you that, in my opinion, Hilda Mason was one of the most amazing members of the council that we ever had. She was really, she was everything a politician should be in terms of, she was independent, she was smart, she was politically savvy, and she was in politics for the right reason, which was that she cared about people and she wanted to make change. I can't say enough good things about her. But let
me
ask,
not only a member, she's not only a member, but she was national vice chairperson of DSA for many years.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. But she was just the most amazing person, and I was lucky enough to meet her early on in my political career, because she came to an event and they didn't know she was coming, and they put her at a table by herself, and they came over to me and my date. This was back in the days while I was still single, and they asked me to sit with her so that she wouldn't be alone, and we didn't know who she was, and I met her and was absolutely captivated by her and followed her career, and she had an amazing career.
Yes.
But let me ask you something, Bill. You're on the DSA national website, they describe your organization not as a party but as an activist organization. And I think you just mapped that out. But didn't your party grow out of the Socialist Party of America, where Eugene Debs was a candidate several times for president? I mean, was there a transformation from being a political party to being an activist group?
Yes, absolutely. And DSA traces its roots back to Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party that came into being in the late 1800s. And that party went on, and it reached sort of a high point in 1912 when Debs ran for president, got nearly 1 million votes. But it tailed off after that with repression. There were a couple of phases of Red Scare, and then the McCarthy era, and the Socialist Party dwindled. And without getting into a long, complex history, there was some reformation in the '60s, early '70s, when a predecessor of DSA called the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee grew out of the old Socialist Party and said, what the Socialist Party had been doing for decades mostly was running somebody for president and getting a tiny fraction of a percent of the vote. And Michael Harrington, you may be familiar with, kind of led the movement to say, this is really not productive. We need to come up with a different strategy. And so formed an organization that, as the website says, is an activist organization that intervenes in politics, but is not itself a party, but whose purpose is to spread the notion of democratic socialism as an answer for many of America's problems. And that was the foundation of Democratic Socialists of America.
And your party, or your activist group, let's call you an activist group, these days supports Bernie Sanders, does it not?
Yes. DSA is working very hard for Bernie Sanders this year, as we did in 2016. And even going back years before that, his campaigns for Congress and Senator, I was involved in a fundraiser here in D.C. for Bernie's first campaign for Senate back in 2006. So DSA has been associated with Bernie Sanders going way back.
And he's getting any sense? Do you guys have any sense why he's getting so much traction these days, as opposed to not that he did bad in 2016, but he seems to have emerged as a potential fundraiser, as a potential front runner. It may end up being him and Biden and Bloomberg. I don't know, but for our listeners who might not know, the mayor of Indiana dropped out of the race today. And Steyer also dropped out. So it's getting to be a smaller and smaller field.
Michael, could you speak about the strategy of that before Super Tuesday? I don't understand why 48 hours wouldn't have been a prudent time to wait.
Well, because I think they didn't have money to in Buttigieg's case, I think he doesn't have the money to go forward, and he understands that. And I think in Steyer's
But imagine case, his name recognition. I voted on Friday. In California, our polls have been open since February 22nd. So I'm traveling on Tuesday, so I went. You just name recognition. California is super gay friendly. We're super blue. Like, why wouldn't you have lingered?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. That's a question you have to ask his campaign, because you're right. He may do okay in California. He may do. It doesn't cost you any money to hang in for 2 days.
Right. And I know Bernie's got more boots on the ground in California than anybody, and has for months. He's got at least 200 folks doing door-to-door in under-neglected and overlooked neighborhoods, especially that don't speak English.
Well, that's literally a brilliant strategy. He's done well with Latinos, even in South Carolina.
And Texas.
In Texas, yeah, absolutely. So, I don't know. That's a good question for Buttigieg. I think in for Steyer, he saw the writing on the wall.
Well, yeah.
And Bill, what do you think? What do you think is Bernie's strategy going forward? Do you have any reflection on that as a Democratic Socialist? Do you think he's on the right path? Does he need to change anything?
What he's been doing seems to be working for him. I think he is reflecting a disillusion on people that discussed with capitalism as it's been practiced. The economic meltdown of 2008 turned a lot of people off from the idea that the free market was going to solve our problems. And that helped lead to the Occupy movement of 2011, 2012, and the growing economic inequality in the country, which has shown a lot of people that capitalism just not working for the majority of the people. I mean, one statistic I want to throw at you is that the top 1% of people in the country in terms of wealth have more wealth than have 26 times the wealth of the bottom 99%. Economic inequality has just been galloping in the last few decades. But it took somebody to really punch that through, to step up and say, okay, capitalism is not working. Democratic socialism could be an answer, and that was Bernie Sanders. And he brought it forward and put it on the table. And I think that's what was different, that Bernie was able to stand up and not only nibble around the edges, talk about reform, talk about this and that, but to say that we really need a fundamental change, a fundamental revolution to address the country's problems.
Well, I admire his courage for doing that, and it scares me as a Democrat. I got to be honest with you. It scares me as a Democrat, yes, because I think our main priority needs to be replacing the man we have in the White House right now. And I think a lot of people don't understand what a Democratic Socialist is, and it's one of the reasons we have Bill on the show. But even on the website, Bill, even on your website of the national organization, one of the misconceptions that it puts out there. It asks the question, if so many misunderstand socialism, why do you continue to use the word? Do you know if anybody suggested changing the name of the organization? So that because of the fact that people are so uninformed about it, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people think about socialism is that, you know, all my adult life, almost, we refer to Russia and the collective communist countries as the United Soviet mm-hmm. Socialist Republic. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of people see, you yes. know, they make that connection between the communist regime.
Absolutely.
Authoritarian
I'm guilty
regime.
Of that.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes up every so often. And it came up more in the past than it does now, because the memory of the Soviet era is fading quite a bit. And, you know, I've always thought that no matter what we called ourselves, our enemies would red bait us no matter what. They would call us socialists even if we didn't call ourselves socialists. And so we might as well put the name out there, tell them proudly who we are. And, you know, the changing attitude toward the word socialism is shown in, there was a recent Gallup poll in which 57% of self-identified Democrats had a positive view of socialism, and 37% of all the country had a positive view of socialism. And yeah. In a different poll, 44% of all millennials, regardless of their party identification, today have a positive outlook on socialism. So I think that old memory of the Soviet era is passing, and, you know, DSA has always emphasized that we did not endorse that brand of socialism. There was a stark split between democratic socialism and the kind of Soviet-style totalitarian socialism early in the days when socialism, you know, first came to fore. And there's always been, on the terms of democratic socialists, a great effort to differentiate ourselves from the totalitarian variant. So, and now that the Soviet Union is now almost 30 years in the rearview mirror, people are really coming around to seeing what socialism really is, which in our view is inseparable from democracy.
Well, I've got to say that, you know, not only because I studied it in school and we saw socialism and from the perspective of Marx and Engels and people that you know, started a worldwide movement, we saw it as a tool for analyzing governments as much as you know, an activist tool. But I also have never been bothered by it because I got my first full-time job when I was 14. And I was seriously abused, as many young people are, had wage theft and all sorts of other things, until I became a Teamster. At 17 years old, I lied about my age and joined the Teamsters Union. And, you know, Teamsters were the first people that ever gave me a sick day or any benefits or, you know, and till this day, my business cards carry a union bug. I only deal with union vendors. So there's a lot. There's a lot on a personal level that mm-hmm. I align with as far as what the movement stands for about. And tell us that. Tell us briefly, what does the movement stand for? Putting power in the hands of the people is the way I look at it. But
Sure. The way I look at it is it's a system in which you know, the people, through democratic institutions, make the overarching decisions on the direction of the economy for the benefit of all the people and not for the profit of a few. And I think that's the essential thing, the essential distinction is that socialists believe that we should get beyond this fetishization of the free market and that capitalists should determine the direction of the economy, but that the people have the right to direct the economy for the benefit of all the people. And that doesn't mean that the government owns all enterprises or owns every business. That's the old Soviet model. I personally think there's a large arena for private enterprise, but that certainly the essential services and goods should be directed by the government, like health care. There should be a large government role in housing, for instance. I mean, there already is, you know, socialist ideas have already taken root in that way, and that some enterprises have been found to be too important to be left in the hands of private industry, like schools, like, you know, garbage collection, the fire department. I mean, we have a partly socialized public sector as it is, and socialists would like to, you know, push that a little further so that, you know, the people really do have the, you know, the services they need.
So here's my question, Biggs. I just had a philosophical conversation with one of my Bern sons, and he was saying that capitalism benefits inordinately, excessively, and terribly people like Bezos and Steve Jobs and Warren Buffett, Bill and Melinda Gates. And I said to him, what happens if those same capitalists turn their billions, because he gave me a ridiculous difference between what it is to be a millionaire and what it is to be a billionaire in terms of seconds on the planet. To use a word that is probably not appropriate, to tithe them to give a great amount of their profits to the betterment of our planet. So they're continued to be rewarded for their capitalistic ways, because our life without Amazon is exceedingly different than it was before. So it's not a tax per se, but they're, in other words, to encourage philanthropy, because Bill and Melinda Gates with their foundation are healing the ails of our planet. They've got 7 corporations throughout the world where they're doing good things. Eradicating malaria and literacy and polio and et cetera. So rather than have it mandated it politically, what about have it mandated with a percentage of the profits?
Well, that's, you know, part of the solution. There's proposals for more progressive taxation, as I said, there's still a large arena for private enterprise in the United States, but there needs to be means to equalize wealth and to draw some of this obscene wealth that's being accumulated by the likes of Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Michael Bloomberg.
Mark Zuckerberg.
yes. And, you know, in terms of a wealth tax, raising the top limit on incomes. There have been proposals for investment tax for every time somebody makes a stock transaction, there'd be a tax attached that could go a long way to meeting the needs of society. Private philanthropy is fine, but it only goes so far, and it doesn't really get at the obscene inequalities in wealth that we see today.
Well, and you know what, Maria, I got to interject something here. Okay. The argument that you just made sounds to me like the argument that's been made against feminism for years. You know, that people have said, well, you know, okay, my wife only makes 78% of 78 cents on the dollar, but you know, the money comes to me and I spend the money and I spend the money on my family. So what's the difference? And I think the real difference is control. Is it not, Bill? It's a matter of control. I mean, right. I would, sure, if I had $100 billion, I wouldn't think anything of giving $99 billion of it away. But I still have $1 billion,
right.
You know?
Right.
And right. I think that's really
well, that's
what
why
it comes
I'm saying,
down to control.
Rather than tax and tithe, why don't we start a culture of philanthropy? And you gave it a curious term to me. You said something about voluntary philanthropy, or I just say, why don't we make that endemic into the system of capitalism?
I think the distinction is who makes the decisions about how the wealth in society is used, and would it be the decision of the Jeff Bezoses and the Michael Bloombergs, or do the people through democratic means have the say in how our wealth in society is distributed? And philanthropy today, the billionaires and millionaires get to decide how their money's used. Should we not instead make it subject to a democratic decision?
A cabinet post, if you will.
Well, also
Secretary of Philanthropy.
Yeah,
that'd be a great job.
Yeah,
right?
I would love nothing better than that.
Yeah, of course. And philanthropy can be used for different purposes to serve the philanthropist too. I've known very wealthy people in my political career who have started family trusts and other things to put money into philanthropic causes. But they often put the money into the philanthropic cause that supports what they do. You know what I mean? So
yes.
So it's a way to guard your money against taxes and still have control over the way the money's used. So, I think it's a matter of control. But
yeah, there's plenty of wealth in society that the billionaires can make donations to the causes that are dear to their hearts and still enact fair taxation so that the essential needs of the vast majority of the people are met.
Right. But let me ask you on a comment that you made earlier, Bill, about the whole idea of democratic socialism changing. Do you think, especially the idea that the government doesn't own all businesses, do you see maybe a new paradigm of socialism arising out of places like China, who are trying to incorporate the idea of capitalism and communism together? Is there a new, do you see a new paradigm maybe emerging out of places like that?
I personally don't see China as any kind of model for democratic socialism here. China has really evolved into a state capitalist authoritarian system where the government is directing the direction of the economy, but there's a huge private sector. The workers are horribly exploited, and there are other problems in China, such as the oppression of the Muslim Uyghurs. I don't see China as being any kind of model you would want to follow.
Well, let me ask you about some of the things that the democratic socialists stand for nationally, as they have reported on their website and other things, like Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's become very, very controversial, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea. I'm a new, being 66 years old, I'm a new guy on Medicare. I still use private insurance as a backup insurance. So far, so good for me. But a lot of people talk about the cost of it. Do you think that we need to eliminate private insurance? And does Medicare for all mean the elimination of private insurance?
Yeah, I think ultimately it would be the elimination of private insurance, because one reason that the cost of health care in this country is so great and we're getting so little for it is the profits that are sucked up by the private insurance companies. And, it's really not – I was working on health care for DSA way back in the 1990s, even before the Bill Clinton plan didn't take flight because it got defeated. But, you look at how much money you're spending on health care today. Part of that is a huge part, billions of dollars of that is the profits of the private insurance companies, which a lot of what they do is try to deny coverage to people. And you eliminate that. You can also use the government's leverage to reduce the cost of health care through limiting pharmaceutical costs, which, by the way, Donald Trump said he was going to do when he was elected during the campaign. He promised to do that, and then he forgot about it once he took office. You could also limit doctor's fees and hospital fees. So the government could use its leverage to reduce costs a great deal and actually come up with a health care system that would provide more care for less cost. And it would be done through taxation. So you'd eliminate private premiums. There'd be no more health care premiums. It'd all be through a government tax, and that would then be put into health care. But you could get more health care for less cost under a single-payer type Medicare for All system.
I think that scares people. What about you, Maria? What do you think?
So, having just engaged in this conversation, I've always paid PPO. I've always been self-employed, and my affordable care went from $400 a month to over $1,100 a month.
Yeah.
So it's not affordable by any stretch of the imagination. And then, of course, there's copays and deductibles and stuff. I think that if all the other nations in the world have it for their citizens, there must be a reason that it should be implemented here, and it shouldn't restrict pharma and drugs and doctors, hospitals from making a profit. I mean, we're smart people.
Yeah.
Right. No, it absolutely could be done. Yes. And it's the power of the medical lobby and the pharmaceutical lobby that keeps it from happening.
That would be my guess. And I can't imagine how scary those hallways are with those people making their agenda be a part of our. I mean, come on, $1,100 a month, it's more than that for one person, me, for healthcare. And I'm healthy. I have no prescriptions that I take.
Mm-hmm,
and sure. So somebody's making something off of that, right? Because I'm not in the hospital. I'm not seeing doctors. I'm not filling prescriptions. I'm not doing any of that, and yet I pay it every month, automatically deducted from my checking account so I don't forget.
Well, and that's the same for me. You know, I ran my own business for 25 years,
yes.
And one of the reasons that Mrs. Brown is a school librarian is that when she volunteered at the library and they offered her a stipend to do that, and she was considering whether to go back to work full time or not, and I suggested that she ask for if
benefits.
They would provide her with benefits, and they said yes, and my health insurance for family coverage, and this was 20 years ago, went from $550 a month to three times the cost of my mortgage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, I couldn't afford to sustain that. So when she took the job and she got health benefits with it, it really reduced our you know, out of pocket, like $2,500 a month.
Well, and
I don't know how
income.
Yeah, and I don't know how people that have minimum wage jobs, you know, how they afford those sort of things. But you know, one thing that I didn't see on the website, which would be a, you know, I think is a major factor in all this, is government reform. Is there do you let's get the money out of politics. That would be a really big help, right? Public funding of elections and things like that. Do you have a government reform plank, let's say, to your platform?
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, Democratic Socialists overwhelmingly think that you need to get money out of politics. Things like clean elections, publicly funded elections. We need to somehow undo, if you remember the Buckley decision of many years ago, which said that campaign spending is speech, which it was ridiculous. Absolutely, it's imperative that get money out of politics. Make it so that it's not the richest person who wins, but the person with the best, or the person who has access to the most fundraising, but the person with the best message. And Citizens United, by the way, is something you need to overturn,
right,
which said that private entities can. Independent entities can spend as much money on campaigns as they want if they're separate from the campaign. And that was one of the most horrendous decisions ever put down by the Supreme Court, and we need to overturn that. There's a movement, I think, getting some momentum to launch a constitutional amendment to overturn that. That's a hard road to hoe, but that's another something else we need to attack.
Well, that is a hard road to hoe, because you're asking, in the end, if the courts don't do it, you're asking the people that benefit most to reform it. And, you know, when I worked, just to be honest, I'm a lifelong Democrat. And when I worked at the DNC, we had a thing called the Federal Election Commission, which still exists, which restricts the amount of money that you can put into a political campaign, in a federal campaign. So what did we do? We came up with the idea of non-federal money. You could give money, right? And we could use it for things like party building. And, you know, as long as it wasn't directly connected to a campaign. And, you know, at one point, this is a true story, I got a check for $1 million from Ray Kroc's wife, because she was driving in California one day and Ronald Reagan said something that annoyed her. So she sent us $1 million and we were able to use it. You know, yeah. the maximum you could give was $25,000, but we figured out a way to, you know, put it in a party building. And you know, that's so much gray area. Politicians live in the gray area. They love the gray area, you know, where they can manipulate things to their own self-interest without running afoul of the law. And one of the things they do when they make a law is they leave big gray areas so they can still manipulate, you know. So, yeah, it's going to be tough to get it out of the system.
Well, what about college for all?
College for all, yeah.
Yes, I mean, that's one of Bernie Sanders' big planks is free public college. Yes, and I mean, there is the economic means to do that. It only takes political will.
Yeah, absolutely. And
but
you know what?
The universities, are they not designed to be for profit, and that's where the disparity occurs?
You know, it was not long ago that many public colleges, and we're talking mostly about state colleges, had very minimal tuitions so that people with modest means could go. But over the last couple of decades, tuitions have really skyrocketed, even at the public colleges, and made them much less affordable for people because of cutbacks, state cutbacks in terms of support from the state budget. So we need to turn that around and make colleges affordable to the average person.
Well, and again, you know, I put myself through college. I tell my kids this all the time, but to be honest about it, college cost me $1,000 a year.
Yeah.
Sometimes the books were more expensive than my tuition.
The tuition. Right.
And you know what? Now each one of my kids that went through college, their tuition was $30,000 a year. I don't think one of them. I've got two of the three of them have already graduated, and the third's about to graduate. And I don't think that either one of my kids, even though my daughter graduated top of her class from a good university, she couldn't afford to spend $30,000 a year on an education, even today with a college education.
Yeah.
So how do we expect kids to do that with a high school education?
It's called student loan debt.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
yeah.
I have
and then
been
we loan, then we loan the money to
at
banks.
Usurious rates.
Right. So Elizabeth Warren, this is the one thing I agree with Senator Warren. Well, I agree with several things, but you shouldn't be loaning money to banks at 3/4 of 1%. Right. Which is a discount rate, and then charging kids 8% and 11%.
Yes. I don't know how that's even legal.
No, that's a huge cash cow for the banks to make college loans. They just, again, it's the profit motive that's driving that, and this is something we need to address.
Well, how about the new Green Deal? Look, I can't say enough about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She not only supports D.C. statehood, but in our recent markup, instead of voting yes, she voted absolutely yes. She needed to put an exclamation point there because, and I've talked to her. I talked to her recently, and she's just a – I think she's in politics for all the right reasons. I don't always agree with her, but I think that she's there because she wants to make a better life for the people that were her friends and neighbors growing up, the working class. So I'm glad to see her there. But what about some of the ideas in the New Green Deal that just seem so pie in the sky, like a guaranteed job for everybody with benefits? Can we really do that?
Yeah, I think that the genius of the Green New Deal is that it makes the case that you can limit, attack climate change, limit carbon emissions, but not bankrupt the country in doing so. That it ties job creation and building a new economy to attacking climate change. So building solar panels, developing a smart grid, developing clean energy sources, and putting people to work doing that. Because what really has retarded the environmental movement is the fear that people in carbon-heavy industries like coal and oil and transportation will lose their jobs if fossil fuels get reduced or eliminated. So this makes the case that we can build the economy and protect the environment at the same time. So I think that's absolutely the way we have to go. And Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, I mentioned she's a DSA member, right? She's one of us. So,
I got to tell you that I when I was in college, almost 40 years ago, I took more than 40 years ago, yikes, I took an environmental science course, and they talked about global warming, the warming of the earth, and everything that I studied in that course has come to pass. The violent storms, they predicted back in those days, things like the forest fires you're seeing in California, the violent storms that we've seen around the world that have wreaked such havoc on places like New Orleans and New Jersey and Thailand,
Brazil, Australia.
Yeah. So it's really scary to me, and I think this, and I just got to throw in my two cents here. I think this idea of put more Priuses on the road and, clean coal and things like that are never going to get us anywhere. We really need dramatic action. We need dramatic action.
Right. And another, the socialist angle to this is that so much of climate change and environmental devastation has been driven by the quest for profit, and that coal extraction, oil extraction, highway building has been driven by corporations who make money off of that stuff. And so part of the Green New Deal is that it's a public plan to benefit the public, not put money in the pockets of capitalists, and at the same time protect the environment. So when I think of socialism, I think socialism is at least necessary to achieving that, because we need to take profit out of the equation, because if profit's in the equation, it's not going to get done.
Yeah, and I think it also makes us really, it makes it really, really hard for us to stand alone and try to take a leadership position in this and preach to the world how they should reduce the carbon emissions when, historically, we've been one of the great world polluters. I think it's really hard for us to say to emerging economies, for example, don't use coal, don't use oil. It's cheaper right now. And so it's hard. We have to figure out ways, I think, to really make green energy much more affordable for everybody. So
third world countries like China and like other third world countries see the prosperity of the West, which is built on fossil fuels. So we want to do that too. And as you say, it's hypocritical to say, no, you can't do that. I mean, we did it and we screwed up the environment, so you've got to stay poor. No, it's going to take assistance from the wealthier nations to the third world to build their own green economies and green transportation systems. And it's got to be a global effort. It can't be a country-specific effort.
Yeah.
Well, to that point, though, I was in India, and I was in the slums. I was there with Rotary dispensing the polio vaccine, and they used for fuel cow patties.
Dumb,
so
yeah.
It was the feces from the cow, they would shape into like a little, like a croissant almost, if you will, lay it down in the sun, let it dry, and then they would burn it for heat and for cooking. And you can imagine the carcinogens that come from it and what goes into their lungs, let alone what goes into our world, right? And I said to them, do you see that smoke that's coming up there? That's shooting. When I landed in Delhi, couldn't see the runway until our wheels were on the runway. That's the smog that they have. And they were like, yeah, but it blows away. And I was like, yeah, it stays here on the planet. Might just not stay here where you're burning it. So as a world, we share this environment. So we've got to do it globally.
Well, yeah, and I think that's another part of what I see as part of the New Green Deal is this idea of higher education for all, because a lot of what you just said, Maria, comes from an ignorance about it. And I think that we're always, tempted to see the better side of anything that's in our own self-interest, especially economically. You know, I remember, I don't know if either one of you guys was a smoker. I was a horrible smoker. I thought I would never give it up. Thank God I gave it up 25 years ago. But
good for you.
But, I used to make all those excuses. Well, maybe it's not so bad for you. People die of things all the time. You know what I mean? There's always some way to justify it until the facts slap you in the face and you go, look, everybody in the world says smoking is bad, so I can't be the only guy that's right, and we need to, am I wrong, Bill, here, for democratic socialism to really work, we need to reform the entire economic system in America, is that not true?
Yeah, so we need to eliminate the ideology that the private market should direct the course of the economy, and that it should be put in the hands of the people through democratic means directing the direction of the economy, and that's really the fundamental of socialism.
Well, it's going to be a tough battle, and let me ask you something. Now I don't know what you think about this, but I just read this blob on the website where Socialist Democrats of America put out a news press release today saying that I know they're Bernie supporters, but they said that the Biden campaign and the Democrats rushed into South Carolina and bought the election in South Carolina. If Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey are the sponsors of the New Green Deal, for example, what do you think about your group attacking the Democratic Party?
Oh, I mean, there's going to be vigorous debate within the Democratic Party during the primaries. I think at the end of it, they'll come together and support the Democratic nominee, whoever it is, because we need to defeat Donald Trump. In the meanwhile, people are going to vigorously support whoever they do support, because there really are fundamental differences within the party. I mean, there's a fundamental differences between the views of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Michael Bloomberg, even farther to the right in terms of Democratic politics. So,
Well, we don't know what We don't know what party Michael Bloomberg.
Right.
He's a Republican one day, he's an independent the next day, he's a Democrat the next day.
Yeah, I think party of one, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, party of convenience is really his party. So we're starting to run out of time here, Maria. Do you have any, since you're certainly the most insightful member of the show, do you have another question for Bill?
I do, Bill. Do you suggest that what you stand for is Bernie Sanders for president, or do you also endorse Elizabeth Warren, for example, or are you a one candidate?
DSA has endorsed Bernie Sanders and only Bernie Sanders. And in fact, at the last convention, it said that, you know, they would not make any further endorsements if for some reason Bernie Sanders didn't get the nomination. But I think the individual DSA members will pull together. Most members will support whoever the Democratic nominee is, I believe. But right now the group is pulling hard for Bernie Sanders. And but you know, we don't really attach ourselves to an individual. We have, you know, our vision, and you know, we are going to, you know, forge forward as an organization. And no matter who the next occupant of the White House is.
Well, you know, and I have to say, even though I support another candidate at this point, I have nothing but good things to say about Bernie Sanders, not only because he's a supporter of our statehood bill in the United States Senate and was one of those supporters that we never had to lobby. You know, day one, he was a supporter of the bill. And also, he's done some things for me personally. When I've been a superdelegate at the last three conventions, and I will be a superdelegate, it looks like, at the next one. He's met with me personally to talk about my delegate vote, and he's done some very nice things for me over the years. He's helped us on Capitol Hill and helped me personally on Capitol Hill, you know, because I don't get around so easily up there. I need support sometimes, and he's been one of our big supporters. So God bless him. I like I say, I'm supporting another candidate right now, but you know what? I would have no problem at all supporting Bernie Sanders.
And, you know, Bernie Sanders supported statehood way back in the 1993 vote in the House. When he was a member of the House then. And in fact, he spoke out strongly in favor of statehood then. So his support goes way, way back. And speaking of support for statehood, I want to mention that, you know, that Victor Berger, who was a socialist member of Congress from Milwaukee, in the 1920s proposed a self-government for D.C.
Wow. And you know what? Thanks for mentioning that. I hope if you have any information, you will send it to me, because we're about to go to Milwaukee, as you well know, for the Democratic convention. So I'd like to know more about that. But
Berger, okay, I'll find out what I can about that. There was in a book, a new book written. In fact, I'd commend this to members who want to know more, our listeners who want to know more about socialism. It's a book called We Own the Future. Just came out earlier this year, a collection of essays about what socialism means and what socialists would do if they could. Edited by Peter Dreyer, Michael Kazin, and Kate Aronoff. So I would recommend that to people who want to get more deeply into the subject.
Well, and before we let you go, Bill, give us what your website is, or you know, so that people that want to look in, listeners that want to look into this more, can either hook up with DFA in D.C. or the national organization.
Yeah,
What's the website?
The D.C. website is mdcdsa.org. That's for metrodcdsa.org. And the national website is dsausa.org.
Well, thank you, Bill Moseley, for being our guest today. Do you have anything else to add, Maria? We really appreciate you being on the show, Bill.
Appreciate you having me.
What do you think about the traction that you're getting with Bernie's success thus far?
Listen, DSA, a few years before the 2016 election, had 5,000 national members. Today, our membership is at about 60,000.
Wow.
So Bernie's promotion of socialism has really helped explode our organization into good directions.
Wow. I'll say.
That's great. Well, we're going to leave you. This song goes out to Bill Moseley. We always leave you with the song at the end of the show, and all the other people out there that are working for a better America. It was written by an American treasure named Woody Guthrie. So we leave you tonight with Union Made by Billy Bragg and Company. And thank you so much, Bill, for being on
the
show.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right. Great. See you next week. Mm-hmm.
Give the people their right to vote.